You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, banks, businesses, and schools across Oakland shut down yesterday. The rich are getting richer, but the ranks of the poor are growing. Your cash-strapped state can save billions by saying no to the health insurance leeches. Federal authorities, there was a terror arrest yesterday in Georgia, getting no press. Why? Because they weren't Muslims. And the Republicans have put BP into the witness protection program. Just a few of the things we're going to talk about throughout the day. Right now, however, first of all, let's start out with what happened in Oakland. Joshua Holland, an editor and reporter over at Alternet, and senior writer, in fact, an editor at Alternet, alternet.org, has been keeping us up to track on all of this. And Joshua, you were there last night. What happened in Oakland?
Tom. It was another hectic night in Oakland after a very peaceable day. So we saw kind of both sides of the Occupy Oakland action and what's been going on out there. During the day, there had been a very major protest that had successfully shut down the port of Oakland, the fifth busiest container port in the United States. It was a fairly dramatic victory for a small group of activists. And then later in the evening, things devolved pretty quickly. I took a dinner break and went back out there at about 10:30. There was a festive feeling in the air. I think that the activists were in a way celebrating their apparent victory during the day. And I was told by one, I'm not supposed to call them organizers because it's a non-hierarchical organization, but one of the people who's a key person out there, that the next stage for Occupy Oakland was to reclaim some abandoned buildings because they have a housing problem. That's one of the local problems that they're dealing with. And apparently a group of activists went and, quote-unquote, occupied a former housing shelter, a former homeless shelter. And pretty soon we started to get word, and there's a lot of rumors going around these things, so you never know if it's true or not, that there was a large number of police in riot gear massing to go and evict the people in that building. At this point, several hundred of the activists, maybe 200, the building is located maybe three blocks away from their main camp in front of City Hall. Went to this street a few blocks away, set up a barricade from, you know, pieces of construction materials and garbage, et cetera, and soon thereafter, sure enough, I counted 16 vans filled with riot gear. There must have been about 300 there. The barricade was set on fire. And very quickly, what had been an extremely positive day, there had been two incidents of vandalism, but certainly no violence, no arrests, devolved into another one of these scenes similar to what we saw last Tuesday with endless rounds of tear gas being fired, flashbang grenades, less lethal
projectiles. This was not at the port. This was at the homeless shelter?
No, this is not at the port. The port was an extremely nonviolent action. Nothing.
Very interesting, because the two have been conflated in the news.
Joshua. You know, I heard NPR say that they had, that this had been, some violence and arrest of lingering protesters.
Right.
It's possible that there were some people at the port at 4 in the morning, for example. I left at about 3 in the morning.
Right.
The action that I saw where there was quite a bit of violence and a number of arrests was at the homeless shelter.
Right. Okay, two quick questions in the short time we have. The first is, if you look back at the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, the 60s was the time of the nonviolent civil rights movement. You know, turn the fire hoses on us, et cetera. And that produced the Great Society and a lot of changes. The 70s were a time of violent response. You know, cities were burned down, including Oakland. And and frankly, it seems to me that that produced social change as well. It was almost like, okay, the promise of the 60s hasn't been fulfilled. We're mad as hell. We're going to do something about it. Is it possible that we've been over-romanticizing the nonviolent acts, aspects. I'm not that I'm advocating violence in any way.
Right.
But that when a rigidified system of crony capitalism and crony politics is confronted repeatedly, that it will respond with violence. Well, this is my second question. We had on yesterday the head of the Oakland Police Officers Association, and I asked him, did the mayor tell you to use these tactics against the protesters a week ago Tuesday, or did you guys just do it on your own? And he said, we just did it on our own. We just had a general order to clear the park, and it was our decision. So, you know, when you make the most violent people, the people who deal with violence on a daily basis, when you make them responsible for the decision about whether to use violence, guess what's going to be most frequently used? It might carry home from this. So I'm just curious your thoughts on all of that, you know.
Well, I think that before I even answer that, I really think it's important for me to point out that this wasn't a violent movement by the protesters so much as it was a small group of protesters who built the barricade and lit it on fire, and that was a provocative move.
Right. Well, let me also then point out that in the 70s, in every single case, in Detroit, in Oakland, in Watts, I don't remember the list now, and it's been a lot of years, but in every single case, every one of those incidents where city blocks were set on fire was precipitated by a police shooting incident or a police beating incident. Every single one without exception.
Right. So, I want to make the point that, you know, one of the chants last night was don't throw stuff. They used a different word that starts with S at the police. So, I mean, you know, the vast majority of these protesters do believe in nonviolent revolution.
Right.
To answer your question, I think that there's two ways of looking at this. You know, clearly, if you provoke a violent response, you get an enormous amount of media attention to your cause. You get a lot of, we've seen in these protests, you get a lot more sympathizers the next day. Again, there was, as I mentioned last week, there was 500 people out there last Tuesday. When I went back out on Wednesday, there was 1,500 people. And last night in Oakland at the port, estimates vary, but there were, I would say, upwards of 10,000 people. So these violent responses have led to a huge amount of participation. But the other way of looking at it is this. First of all, you're not going to win. You're not going to win in a violent confrontation because you are outgunned in a very extreme way, as we see dramatically on the, you know, each night we see this happening in Oakland.
We have 1 minute, by the way, Joshua.
Okay, the other thing is just, you know, looking at the state of our mainstream media, I think it's so easy to dismiss protesters and have them fit the kind of narrative of hooligans that I don't know if that attention ultimately does more than, you know, expand among like-minded people.
Well, and in fact, when you look at the coverage on Fox News, you know, where they're calling these, you know, basically, you know, dirty, violent hippies kind of stuff.
Yes.
You could argue that the Reagan Revolution of the 80s was a blowback against the violence of the 70s.
Oh, I think that that's a very important point. Yes.
Yeah. So it's like, be careful what you wish for. You might get not only that over the short term, but the exact opposite over the long term.
Or the Nixon revolution as a response to the 60s.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I would say that that's probably even a more clear example, although most of our listeners and viewers are probably not old enough to remember it.
I'm not old enough to remember it either, Tom.
Well, I am. I'll just tell you right up front. I am. And I remember it well. Joshua Holland, editor, reporter, senior writer at alternet.org. Joshua, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Always great. Always great. We'll be back. My question for the day is, how do you bring about genuine change, revolution in America today?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I'm not talking about, you know, the Tea Party slogans of, you know, quoting Jefferson about the blood of patriots and all that. I'm talking about, how do you bring about change without violence?
Occupy Wall Street is doing what we've all been thinking. Let's get off the couch and start shouting that this ship is sinking. We all love our country, our freedom, and our liberty. But corporate money.
There you go. So well said. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it possible to have genuine change in any nation where the system has become rigidified by great wealth or corporate power without kicking over some flower pots? I'm reluctant to use the word violence because it has overtones of the French Revolution and killing people and guillotines and you know, bringing guns into the streets. And frankly, I don't think any of that is necessary. I think that we had a revolutionary period in the 1770s and again in the 1860s that involved enormous amounts of violence. There were revolutionary periods in the United States since then, including the rise of the progressive movement, the union movement, that did involve some violence, but it was mostly violence directed at protesters. Detroit and Watts burned in the 70s. Was it necessary? Was it actually counterproductive? Did it produce a right-wing backlash in the United States that elected Richard Nixon and ultimately Ronald Reagan, or not? How does change happen in this country? Now, I have some opinions I'll be sharing with you as we go through the day, but I don't have certainty on this. This is one of those areas where you can read the histories of five different nations, or for that, just looking at American history, and you can draw different conclusions from the exact same data. Here's a conversation that Jacob Dean, our producer, had. When was this, Jacob?
Sunday.
And this is a conversation that Jacob had Sunday with James Cox, who was an Occupy Chicago patriot. She was arrested twice in Chicago during the crackdown last week. She was harassed and abused by the police in jail. Here it is.
Would you mind talking about what you mean by assaulted? What did they?
Well, basically, they forced me to go into solitary confinement because I was asking for a mattress. They had given us all mattresses that day and then took them away, and the guards were messing with us all day. You know, it's concrete beds. They had the air conditioning going, so it was intentionally uncomfortable. It was cold. We didn't have any pillows, no blankets, no nothing, just laying on concrete. And so they took the mattresses away and promised that they would give us back at 10 o'clock. They were for overnight guests. So 10 o'clock rolled around, and I asked for my mattress. And they were like, no, change of plans. We've been given direct orders not to give you guys any mattresses. So the position that we were was kind of in the back of the jail, and the guards and stuff were in front. So we had to, like, pound on the door and yell to get their attention. So I was pounding like we had been doing all day. And the guard came back there, and she was like, come with me. Took me to solitary confinement, and I told her that I wasn't going in there. I was like, can you tell me what I've done? Why are you putting me in here? And she then at that point grabbed me, threw me against the wall, which luckily the walls were padded or else I might have some injuries, banging my head against into the wall, bringing me to the ground and then back up again. I was screaming. Another guard came in because she heard the commotion. The first person was a detention aide. The second person that came in was an actual officer, and at that point, the detention aide and the officer both had their hands on me, throwing me around like a rag doll. A third person came in, which was another officer. The whole issue was they were trying to get me to take my shoes off. I don't know if you've ever been harassed and assaulted or not, but if both of your hands are trying to get people off of you or both of your hands are contained, you cannot take your shoes off. So she instructed me to take my shoes off, and I instructed her that I was unable to do so because I was being physically assaulted. So I got my shoes off finally after wrestling with them, and then they closed the door, and I learned that there was no toilet paper, there was no water. It was basically four padded walls, and there was a hole in the floor for the toilet. The toilet was facing the door. The door had a window, so any male officer or male guard walking by could see me using the bathroom. So it was very uncomfortable. I don't think that any of my actions warranted a need for solitary confinement. I think they were trying to make an example out of me, but I'm here now, and I did it for the movement, and yeah, I'm just glad to be out in the free world again.
Yeah, it's called being thrown into the hole. And James said that she wasn't going to let, James Cox, who Jacob interviewed, said she was not going to let this deflate her efforts, her energies. Here's her follow-up thoughts.
Any words of encouragement to those who might be afraid to show up, might be afraid of getting arrested? Do you have anything you'd say to those people?
I just want to remind everyone, I want to take it back sort of to the civil rights movement for women's rights and for the rights of minorities. Those people were afraid too. They were being chased by dogs. The hoses were pulled out on them. They were beaten. I don't think that it's a matter so much of being afraid. Any great thing is going to take some sacrifice, and it's going to take strength and determination. We can't be afraid. Right now is not the time to be afraid. Right now is the time to be brave. I can't be afraid myself because it's past that. We're already afraid to speak out and to stand up, so I can't be afraid any longer, and I don't think that any of my brothers and sisters are either.
There you go. fear is not an option. Steve in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Steve, your thoughts?
Yes, Tom, how are you?
Fine.
I had a question. Occupy Philly, as I had explained to you yesterday, was joined the other occupations to call for, in their message, a constitutional amendment to eliminate corporate personhood.
Right.
They had also had some suggested, they were the first group that suggested some measures, some action steps to do that. And I wanted to have your thoughts on a couple of the measures that they suggested, and if you could have anything
sure.
else.
If we can do it quickly, we have about 40 seconds here before the break.
Okay. One of them was refraining from buying anything other essential, other than essential of life purchases.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to national peaceful and inspirational rallies and other necessary measures. I mean, what they're talking about is basically the congressmen and the senators probably are not going to go with this very easily.
No, there actually used to be a movement about this back in the 80s. It was called Voluntary Simplicity. What was the second one, very quickly?
The second one was refraining from buying anything other than essential of life purchases.
I see. Okay. Yeah. That's you know, it's a great idea, and I think all of us need to live more lightly on the earth. Whether that's going to be transformational politically, I doubt it. But that's, you know, that's the problem with boycotts. Steve, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's like when you define your power as your economic power and you're not in the 1%, you're not defining your power. Your power is to speak out and be in the streets.
Stand up, we shall not be moved, except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Stand up, we shall not be moved, except by a woman dying from a loss of blood.
Stand up, speak out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. What's the possibility of actual change being brought about? What's the process by which change is brought about in the United States? Yeah, you could argue that Reagan was the blowback against the violence of the 70s. I think, frankly, you could also argue that maybe the Carter election was in 76, because most of that happened in the early 70s. I mean, maybe they had no impact on it. And frankly, had Bill Casey, Reagan's campaign manager, not cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages until the election, until after the election day. In fact, they released them the minute that Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible to take the swearing in January of 2001. That's the moment that they released the hostages. Had Bill Casey not cut that deal to hold the hostages for a year, Jimmy Carter would have been president, would have been reelected president. So maybe it had nothing to do with it at all. Paul in Round Mountain, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. So in answer to your question, I think that what you do to change or an effect change is you frame the issue so that everybody can understand it.
Right.
And then you take action to bring your concept to the public.
And to highlight that issue.
Right. Mm. And I think it's already been done. It's been 2 months since the Occupy Wall Street first came into being. The conversation in the country has changed from deficits to social justice.
Right.
So apparently...
Everywhere except on Fox.
Pardon me?
Everywhere except on Fox. Yes.
Well, everywhere on MSNBC also. I mean, yeah. They're talking about the movement, but they're not talking about the financial terrorism that is causing the discomfort across the country.
Right.
But they will.
Well, I'm not sure they will. I don't, you know, I didn't see any of that on the morning shows and the Sunday morning shows. I'm not seeing much of that on the television news. Certainly the right wingers aren't talking about that. We had, you know, Curtis Sliwa on yesterday. He does a big right wing talk show in New York City, and he was all about, you know, it's a bunch of hippies and they want to make love and smoke dope and poop in the park kind of thing. And that's the right wing narrative. And I think that's a narrative that's very out of touch with the American people. I mean, we just got this statistic today. Over 20 million Americans are now living at 50% of the poverty level or below. That's the highest level of the poorest of the poor that we've ever seen in this country. It's incredible.
Tom, I was in Caracas, Venezuela, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, 80% of the people are on the deficit side of the economy. They're poor people.
Right.
But they, if you ask them, they can tell you what the IMF is, what the World Bank is, what sure. they do. But in the United States, someone who goes to a four-year university would not be able to tell you.
Right. Well, that's, you know, Chavez has done a good job of educating his people about those issues. And there is, you know, their equivalent of NPR actually talks about that stuff because it doesn't take money from corporate sponsors. Our NPR doesn't talk about those things. I call it national.
Then just to kind of wrap it up, you know, I've noticed that these occupations have turned out to be communities in and of themselves. So if people are going, they have medical tents, people are getting medical care there that they haven't been able to get. You know, that's the only right. medical care that
this was the conversation I had last night with the representative of National Nurses United. And he was like, you know, we're setting up medical tents to provide medical services to the people in the Occupy movement in the occupied areas around the nation. And what's happening is all kinds of folks are showing up just because they need medical care. And not only that, I think the entire dynamic is changing. I mean, did you just hear that interview that Jacob did with this young woman, James Cox? Young people are getting educated about civics and politics. And so, you know, that what you saw in the favelas of Caracas is starting to happen here. And I think that that's a very good step. Paul, thank you. Fascinating point you brought up. Thank you. It's a very, very important one. Jim, I don't have a city for you. It says you're listening in KTLK, though, so I'm assuming L.A. area.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Hi, Tom. I listen to you every day. I could say I'm a conservative, a little bit on the center, not too far right. But I do believe that the answer is somewhere in the middle between what you say and what the right wing is saying. It's not totally. No system is perfect.
I have no idea what that means, Jim.
Well, what that means is this: there's value and benefit of having a healthy capitalistic free market system plus some compassion for some people that cannot help themselves.
So you're advocating basically the Norwegian system?
I don't know what the Norwegian
or the Swedish system. Well, in those countries you've got capitalism and it works very well. You've got, you know, the state doesn't own any industries or any major industries, but they also, you know, have a tax rate that's high enough that CEOs literally don't make more than 30 times what the lowest paid employee makes. They keep their money in the companies, they grow the companies, and people are paid good wages. They've got solid middle classes.
Well, that's the problem of what you're preaching, Tom. I really respect you. You're a very knowledgeable guy, and I know you're sincere about your beliefs.
But
the system that you're preaching is preaching the wrong values, in my opinion. And these Occupy movements are also preaching the wrong values. It's preaching dependencies and laziness versus getting out there and trying to. There's another thing they're not realizing is that the current administration has.
What? No, Jim, I'm sorry. I can't just let that slide by. What these people are, and I obviously don't speak for any of the Occupy movements. I speak for myself. But I can tell you what I'm protesting and what I think a lot of other people are protesting is the fact that we have an economy that is basically crony capitalism. We have a bought and sold Congress. We have a system where money rules. We have a Supreme Court that is totally corrupted and has made a whole set of rules that say corporations are people and money is speech. And the result of that is that since Ronald Reagan came into office, the top 1% of wage earners in the United States, the top 1%, has seen a 257% increase in their income, whereas the bottom 80% has seen bupkis, nothing, basically nothing. And that's wrong. And that's a function of tax policy. And that has nothing to do with my saying, hey, you know, I want welfare or anything. This has got nothing to do with welfare. People are not asking for welfare. They're asking for a damn job.
Yeah, Tom, if businesses are working these days and there's a lot of capital in the country that's afraid of risking and going into business because of today's policies, half of these people are
because of 30 years of Reaganomics.
No, not
name for me, Jim, please, one business that is not that has demand for their products and is not hiring people to fill that demand because they're afraid of uncertainty. If you can name one product or one company.
There's a lot of businesses that are not expanding.
Name one.
Because of,
name one.
What's that?
Name one. There are none. I defy you to name one. You will hear this talking point over and over and over again on right-wing talk radio and on Fox News. And if there was even one company in the United States whose CEO said, you know, there are people out there who want to buy more of our computers. There are people out there who want to buy more of our burgers. There are people out there who want to buy more of our shirts or jeans. But I'm uncertain about things, and so I'm not going to hire anybody to make them. I'm not going to increase my corporate profits. I'm not going to make more money for my organization because I'm afraid of uncertainty. It is a total BS line. It is a lie from the right.
Tom, you're missing a point here. If those people that are going to buy things don't have jobs to even buy what they want to buy.
You're making my point.
Let me ask you something. Do you think we're living in a business-friendly environment these days?
I think it's more business-friendly than it's ever been. Business profits in the last 5 years have been higher than they have ever been in the history of this country, Jim. The business profits last year were higher than they had been in any year since George Washington was president. Are you trying to tell me that we're living in a business-unfriendly environment?
Very unfriendly environment. And
Jim, you're
you
hallucinating.
Why.
You're smoking something. How can you say that when last year corporate profits were higher than they have ever been in the history of the United States?
Okay, I'll tell you.
What is your evidence?
In my opinion, which I agree with you there, the sign of a healthy society is a society that have a very strong middle class. That's
yes,
what
sir.
I believe.
I agree with you.
And the middle class could be strong when they have jobs.
I agree.
And people that are sitting on their capital, hear them out. Don't just brush this theory away as a conspiracy by Fox or anybody. It is true. It's out there. And the more you keep saying that, the more people believe it. And those guys that are occupying places in those movements believe it. Let me give you an
people,
example.
People are sitting on capital because it is more profitable than trying to sell things. We're in a depression right now. There is no demand. Now, you can do one of two things. If you run a business, if there are people who want to buy your products, of course, you hire people to make more product and you sell it. But people are sitting on their money because there's no demand. There's no demand because wages have been flat for 30 years because of Reaganomics.
That's not the only reason. The other reason is that the buyers out there have no jobs. So nobody's
that's what I'm talking about. Demand is caused by wages. The sole source of demand in our economy is wage. Well, not the sole source. 80% of demand in the U.S. economy is wages. The remaining 20% is government spending. And so if you have wages that have been flat for 30 years and are actually falling off right now, demand collapses. When demand collapses, of course, people are not going to make things to sell. So the solution is to increase demand.
Before the recession hit, salaries were incredibly high.
Okay, I miss that. Jim, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think Jim said that when the recession hit, salaries were incredibly high. And in fact, no, Jim, again, salaries over the last 30 years, ever since Reagan, have been steadily collapsing. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And David in New York City. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hi. We've talked before. I just wanted to mention that there's one key component that people are kind of overlooking, and that's shame. I mean, we're already starting to educate people on what's really going on. And then the shame, the powers that be that are shipping our jobs overseas, that don't care about us, the politicians who don't represent us. And the more shame comes into the picture, the more things will start falling in line. I mean, to give an example, look at Madoff's son. I mean, he had everything going for himself, family, money, and he blew his brains out because he couldn't handle the shame.
Yeah.
So shame is a very intense component in all this, I really believe.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And in fact, I would say if you go back and you look at the history of the 1935 Flint sit-down strike, that basically those workers, it wasn't just a our power versus your power confrontation. It was, we are on the side of what's right, and General Motors, as I recall it was, is on the side of, you know, what's right for the 1%. And the workers were saying, we're on the side of what's right for the workers. And that led to the Wagner Act in 1935, and it led to the right to unionize, and it led to a whole lot of other good, positive changes. I would say that every, as I pointed out to Joshua Holland earlier, every single time one of the cities went up in flames in the early 1970s in the United States, it was provoked by a police shooting or police violence, you know, a Rodney King type of incident or worse. And
I've been trying to shame Curtis Sliwa. I mean, it's pathetic. I was here in the early 80s, and they did a lot of good, and they stood up for the people that weren't being represented and helped little old ladies that the cops weren't helping getting mugged. And now he's a shill for Fox Corporation.
Yeah,
News Corp.
Really, you know, Curtis isn't here to defend himself. You can take that up with him. He's on the radio in your city.
I've been dealing with him directly, so
okay.
That's the thing. I'm just saying, if you felt bad too, I mean, I just can't believe what's happened to him. It's
It is.
I'll let you go to next.
Okay, thanks a lot, David. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening to us there. Mike in Newport, Oregon. Hey, Mike, what's up? Mike, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, Tom, this is Mike. I'm sorry. I was listening to you on speakerphone. I'm calling about a letter that was sent evidently by a bunch of congressmen, you know, Democrats and Republicans to the Super Commission.
Yes, it was 40 Republicans and 60 Democrats.
Yeah, and what amazes me beyond the 40 blue dogs is the 20 so-called progressives. A couple of them are in my state, Fazio and Schrader. And I've already sent a screaming letter off to Schrader and called his office. I'm curious about this. They're actually walking away from anything, and they're saying, "Hey, we're ready to give up the farm again, you know, as long as you take a little bit of."
Yeah, I don't know that DeFazio signed that letter. I'd have to look at the list.
Yeah, he says he did. Okay. I read online that he's on there, and Schrader's on there.
Okay, Schrader wouldn't surprise
Schrader's
me.
Schrader's always, it doesn't surprise me either. He's not the liberal I thought he was.
No, I don't think that Kurt Schrader ever said that he was a liberal. He always campaigned. I mean, that was a district that Darlene Hooley held before him, and she was not a liberal. She was basically a, you know, kind of that's a district that includes Lake Oswego and whatnot. You know, some very wealthy areas, if my recollection is correct. I mean, that was my representative.
We're basically here on the coast, though, and in Newport itself.
Yeah.
You know, in Lincoln County, we're pretty liberal. I mean, our numbers are probably 65%, you know, to 35 or 60 to 40.
Yeah, but I think the bottom line here, Mike, is whether, you know, without getting into micro politics, because, you know, we've got a national audience here that probably has no idea what you and I are talking about. But the bottom line is that 40 Republicans signed a letter saying to the Super Committee saying consider tax increases, which is pretty startling. I mean, they basically took on Grover Norquist. 60 Democrats signed the letter. Saying basically what the letter said was put everything on the table. And so, therefore, 60 Democrats were signing a letter that said, please consider tax increases, but also, you know, please consider cuts to Social Security and Medicare and things like that, which I think was a big mistake. You know, for the Democrats on that list. And so I'm with you on that. That's just where I'll leave it. Thanks for the call. Josh in Oakland. Hey, Josh, what's up? Speaking of Oakland.
Hi.
Hey.
Okay. I'm a little nervous. Sorry.
It's okay.
I actually am very impressed with your historical accounts of why the system is the way it is, especially the in 1886, the Santa Clara County thing.
Sure.
Corporations are not people. Obviously, they're big buildings.
Yeah. They're not people anywhere. Actually, they're a legal abstraction. They're a piece of paper filed with the Secretary of State, if you want to get really super technical about it. But you're right. They're not, you know, they're not human.
I'm looking at that right now from one of your books.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about speaking in Oakland, and I really want to make sure that I get the right message across, and everything that you say is pretty much, you know, something that I base all of my arguments off of.
My books generally are fairly heavily footnoted, if that's of any help.
Yeah, exactly. So corporations aren't people, and money is not speech is the basic message, right?
Right, and the Supreme Court took the step in the direction of corporations are people. The biggest, the most famous step in 1886, they actually didn't take that step, but the clerk said they did, and it's been followed ever since. I mean, then, you know, within a decade, the court was quoting that headnote. But the money is speech part, that was Buckley versus Vallejo, which I think was 1974. It was in the early 70s. And that was the decision where the Supreme Court said money is not speech. And that's the decision that six, as I recall, U.S. Democratic U.S. senators yesterday introduced a constitutional amendment into the Senate for ratification, for consideration, that would roll back not just Citizens United, but also Buckley versus Vallejo, that would say that, no, money is not speech. And, in fact, the people of the United States, through their elected representatives, have the power to regulate campaign financing.
Okay. So I'm also a little concerned with Oakland right now because the actual movement went to shut it down, but like in the middle of the night, they ended up rioting.
Well, no, actually not at the Port of Oakland, according to the report from Joshua.
Yeah, it was.
That was another group that decided to take over an empty building, and the police said you can't do that. And we don't know if that group was part of the Occupy Oakland or not, or you know how that decision was made or anything. So let's not prejudge that, although I guarantee you Fox will be. Josh, I don't have an answer beyond that. That's literally everything I know about it. Thank you very much for the call. Robert Greenwald is up next. New documentary, Who Are the 1%?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across the Americas, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via Free Speech TV. More people watch or listen to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back. Glad to have you with us. Robert Greenwald on the line. We are partnering with Robert in this new project, our program, among others. And so Robert will be joining us often for updates on who are the 1%. Robert, welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. And it's great to be partnering with you and all of your incredible listeners and activists and viewers.
Thank you. And let me just put a couple of URLs out here. First of all, you are the producer, director, political activist, and founder and president of Brave New Films, bravenewfoundation.org. But this is who are, as A-R-E, who are the 1%.com is the website for this particular action that we're collaborating or that you're working on and I'm trying to support. And tell us, who are the 1% and what are you doing with this?
Well, what we all, of course, Tom, and you've been talking about it in wonderful fashion, we've all been inspired and encouraged by the Occupy folks. So a lot of the time that we at the Brave New Foundation, we try to think about how can we be helpful, what's not being done. And we realize that what is not being done and plays to our skill set is to identify who actually are the 1%. Who are those people with more wealth and more power and are using that wealth and power to keep down the other 99%? Because it's not just about money. It's how you use the money and what you're doing with it. And we felt that it was a helpful and also important way so that people can begin to understand what are that 1% doing? How do they make their money and wealth? We're going to have a continued voting about what is the dirtiest deed that they've done and ultimately identify the dirty dozen, if you will. For now, we've been having a great outpouring already this morning with people making suggestions and explaining, is it the Waltons or is it the Kochs or is it the head of the Bank of America? The names are flying in, and sadly, there's a very, as you can imagine, long list to choose from.
Right, and then the defense contractors. You've done a piece on that, too.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. The defense contractors who pretend, and maybe this is among the most disgusting and outrageous, pretending that it's about jobs, and really what it's about is men, primarily men, making $20, $30, $35 million a year in salary and stock bonuses, because that's what their focus is at these large war profiteering companies.
Right,
are way up there.
Right, which makes them the top 1/100th of 1%. It's really mind-boggling.
It really is. And I've been reading up on this, Tom, and you know this, of course, but there was a while ago when war profiteering, it was a question. Eisenhower said, and there were House and Senate investigations, should anybody be allowed to profit from the war? Well, not only has that gone, we're now rewarding these profiteers, and we hope and we believe in the 1% campaign, we will call them out.
Yeah, and you, in fact, here's what Franklin Roosevelt had to say about this.
Our present emergency and
World
a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
Now, Robert, when FDR said that in 1940, I think it was 41 or 42, and Harry Truman actually started a commission as a senator to look into, you know, who was profiting off the war. There was a broad American consensus that, yes, we don't want war millionaires. Now these guys, they live in lavish mansions. They're considered the height of society. They're you know, the people bow and scrape as they walk into restaurants. I mean, what has happened in America? How have we turned into a nation that worships the 1% when we used to be a nation that looked at the 1% as the leeches on the back of the body politic in society?
Well, I think we want to bring a campaign now, Tom, just based on what you said, bring the leeches back. You know,
or stop the actually,
stop
I'm
the
viewing
leeches.
Them as, yeah.
Yeah. Stop the leeches. Well, I think that we've been propagandized, pure and simple. The 1% have spent an enormous amount of time, energy, and money and convincing us in a multitude of ways that they are indeed have our self-interest, which, of course, they don't. And
right.
Again, the war profiteers being just an obvious, outrageous example as people and men and women are being sent off to die and people in all kinds of countries are dying, these people are profiting at obscene levels and are trying to convince us the only thing they care about is more security. We saw it with the bankers. We see it with Wall Street. And they are using the media. They are using their position in society, and they're playing on people's some level of envy to try to convince us that these are the idols. But that's, I think, what we all have such a wonderful reason to thank the Occupy folks for helping change the conversation and putting a spotlight on these folks. And that's what we're trying to do with the help of you and your partnership on the Who Are the 1%. So people really start to think, wait a minute. Who are they? How are they screwing me? What are they doing with their money? And this is how the system works.
Right. WhoAreThe1%.com is the website. We're talking with Robert Greenwald, the producer, director, political activist. Robert, I'm old enough to remember, probably shouldn't admit this on the radio, but I'm old enough to remember when Jimmy Carter was inaugurated and he walked to the White House for his inauguration. And it was a very low-key event and you know, wealth was not celebrated. And throughout his presidency, not only was wealth not celebrated, but thrift and frugality were promoted. You know, turn down your thermostat, wear sweaters, things like that. Reagan came into office and took the limousine to his inauguration balls. I remember the headlines in the newspaper, wherever I was living at the time, saying words to the effect of glitz, glamour, wealth are back in fashion with the Reagan administration. And, you know, within a year or two, we had movies, you know, like Wall Street saying greed is good. And you had the, you know, Reagan suspending the Sherman Antitrust Act. So the mergers and acquisition mania began, dropping the top tax rate from 74% down to 28% of millionaires and billionaires. And it seems like that was the turning point in America when we stopped viewing the rich as leeches and started viewing them as kings. And it seems like there's a turning back now with the WhoAreThe1%.com, with the work that you're doing. But would you identify that timeline, or do you see something different in the minute we have left here?
No, I agree with you. I think that was the timeline. And it's also a strong argument, Tom, about the way that narratives work. You know, it wasn't that a law was passed saying the rich are kings. It was that the narrative became to accept them that way. And that's one of the reasons that the Occupy people on the ground and the social media is so important. You know, I'm using my Twitter account like crazy to help get these ideas out. And, of course, Facebook has been incredible for Occupy. We're also using it for Who Are the 1%. And, you know, and I know you've been using them actively because it's on the ground and online. And the two together, I think, give us the ability to begin to fight back on the kings and the lords and the 1%.
Yeah, and to change the narrative.
Exactly, which is what we all can do. And, you know, there was some criticism, well, the Occupy people don't have a 10-point plan. Nonsense. Look what they've done in such a short period of time. More than when we had the House, the Senate, and the presidency for Democrats.
Yeah, absolutely. And may it continue. Robert Greenwald, the website, Who Are the One, spelled out O-N-E, WhoAreTheOnePercent.com. Check it out right now. It's fabulous. Robert, thank you so much for being with us today for the great work.
And thank you, partner.
Good talking with you, partner. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How does revolution happen in the United States? More on that right after this.
Welcome to U.S. Occupation. To win the hearts and minds, defend all humankind, tell the banks and the corporations, we're here to occupy the USA.
There you go. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, during this last clip with Robert Greenwald, and I'm guessing that we showed on the screen the WhoAreTheOnePercent.com website and Facebook page. They're, you know, strong, important. These are important things, and it's really worth checking out. WhoAreTheOnePercent.com is the website, and it'll lead you to the other pieces. But in addition to that, there's this question that we've really been struggling with, and struggling with is maybe the wrong phrase, but discussing, trying to work through. And I think America is trying to work through this, and has been, frankly, for a century at least. And maybe since the founding of our country, since our country was birthed in blood. And many countries weren't. Canada, for example, was not birthed in blood. And so the question is, how does change happen in the United States? And how can we most effectively promote change, particularly when the 1% are so entrenched and so powerful and so in control of not just our institutions, but our government itself, that we get news like this today, the richer getting richer, the ranks of the poor are growing. There are now more than 20 million Americans living at 50% of the level of poverty. These are the poorest of the poor. 20 million Americans, over 50 million Americans on food stamps right now. Over 45 million Americans with absolutely no access to health insurance. And probably by now that number is 50 million, because that number is a couple of years old. When you're looking at a significant portion of the American people who have access to nothing, and then people stand up and say, you know, we don't like a system that is run of, by, and for the 1%. We'd like to go back to the time before Reagan, when America was about the 99%. And the 1% were doing fine, but they were only making 30 times what the workers were making, not 3,000 times. And then they get confronted by the police, and then they get arrested. And here's a conversation that our associate producer Jacob Dean had with a woman named James Cox, or who's using the name James Cox, an Occupy Chicago patriot who was arrested twice in the Chicago crackdown last week and harassed and abused in jail by police. Here it is.
Would you mind talking about what you mean by assaulted? What did they?
Well, basically they forced me to go into solitary confinement because I was asking for a mattress. They had given us all mattresses that day and then took them away, and the guards were messing with us all day. You know, it's concrete beds. They had the air conditioning going, so it was intentionally uncomfortable. It was cold. We didn't have any pillows, no blankets, no nothing, just laying on concrete. And so they took the mattresses away and promised that they would give us back at 10 o'clock. They were for overnight guests. So 10 o'clock rolled around and I asked for my mattress. And they were like, no, change of plans. We've been given direct orders not to give you guys any mattresses. So the position that we were was kind of in the back of the jail, and the guards and stuff were in front. So we had to, like, pound on the door and yell to get their attention. So I was pounding like we had been doing all day. And the guard came back there, and she was like, come with me. Took me to solitary confinement, and I told her that I wasn't going in there. I was like, can you tell me what I've done? Why are you putting me in here? And she then at that point grabbed me, threw me against the wall, which luckily the walls were padded, or else I might have some injuries, banging my head into the the wall, bringing me to the ground and then back up again. I was screaming. Another guard came in because she heard the commotion. The first person was a detention aide. The second person that came in was an actual officer, and at that point, the detention aide and the officer both had their hands on me, throwing me around like a rag doll. A third person came in, which was another officer. The whole issue was they were trying to get me to take my shoes off. I don't know if you've ever been harassed and assaulted or not, but if both of your hands are trying to get people off of you or both of your hands are contained, you cannot take your shoes off. So she instructed me to take my shoes off, and I instructed her that I was unable to do so because I was being physically assaulted. So I got my shoes off, finally, after wrestling with them, and then they closed the door, and I learned that there was no toilet paper, there was no water. It was basically four padded walls, and there was a hole in the floor for the toilet. The toilet was facing the door. The door had a window, so any male officer or male guard walking by could see me using the bathroom. So it was very uncomfortable. I don't think that any of my actions warranted a need for solitary confinement. I think they were trying to make an example out of me. But I'm here now, and I did it for the movement. And, yeah, I'm just glad to be out in the free world again.
Yeah, that was James Cox. And she added that this is not going to stop her.
Any words of encouragement to those who might be afraid to show up, might be afraid of getting arrested? Do you have anything you'd say to those people?
I just want to remind everyone, I want to take it back sort of to the civil rights movement for women's rights and for the rights of minorities. Those people were afraid too. They were being chased by dogs. The hoses were pulled out on them. They were beaten. I don't think that it's a matter so much of being afraid. Any great thing is going to take some sacrifice, and it's going to take strength and determination. We can't be afraid. Right now is not the time to be afraid. Right now is the time to be brave. I can't be afraid myself because it's past that. We're already afraid to speak out and to stand up, so I can't be afraid any longer, and I don't think that any of my brothers and sisters are either.
There you go. Fear is not an option. You know, for years we've been saying on this program, despair is not an option. Fear is not an option. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to address a question that you brought up, why greed is so much part of our culture. You know, how did we end up at this point?
When historically it wasn't.
Well, you know, it's become more so, but I think if you look at back at history, particularly the history of economics, which drives a lot of thinking about, you know, how we should conduct economics, how should we conduct business, even John Maynard Keynes said that greed and avarice must be our gods for a while longer. He said that in, I think it was 1933, until we get to a point where we're so rich that then we can deal with these human issues like fairness, justice. If he could, you know, see how desperate the ecology is, and I think he would have probably added that also. But, you know, this just goes to show how twisted this kind of thinking is. It's very deterministic. It's very similar to saying that, to agree Nazi or socialist, or I mean, yeah. Nazi or
John,
communist.
John, we're out of time. I'm sorry. Your point was well made. It's a twisting of Darwin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. How do we produce change in America? Yes. How do you challenge the empire? We just got a comment line call from Alaska with no name. Here it is.
Yeah, Tom's right now saying about the riots in the 70s. Watts, Newark, all those riots were in the 60s, including the Democratic Convention of 68. The 60s ended with the Days of Rage. 1970 opened up with the Empire Strikes Back, which is Kent State. Much more rioting in the 60s than in the 70s. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm going to have to get a timeline of this stuff together and educate myself. Marianne in London, Ontario. Hey, Marianne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I just wanted to tell you that here in London, Ontario, we have probably the highest unemployment rate in Southern Ontario. And on October 22nd, we started our Occupy London, and we now have a major law firm in our city who has offered to be our law firm in case we have any problems with the city or the police or anything. And the CAW has also thrown their support behind us. So we're doing very well, and we're getting some humming and hawing from the mayor, who doesn't like us in a public park. Mm-hmm. But we're dealing with that, and we just want, I just wanted to tell you how well we are doing, and how grateful I am for everything you are doing to support Occupy everywhere.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that's great. I mean, you're Canadian, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is an Occupy London, Ontario, Canada, and you people actually have a national health care system that works. I mean, we're looking at this going, you guys got it pretty good.
But we still do have corporate influence over our government.
Yes.
Prime Minister Harper is lowering taxes on the rich and corporations and hitting government employees and laying them off.
Right. And so, is happening across Europe as well. And people are taking the streets and saying, no, thank you very much. Austerity, neoliberalism, Thatcherism, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't work. It makes life miserable. And we want our government back. We want our country back. Marianne, thank you for the call. And thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I much appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there in London, Ontario. James in Monticello, Kentucky. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Fine. Or is that Monticello?
Yeah, Monticello.
Okay.
Just like Monticello, though.
Uh-huh. So what's up?
I just wanted to talk about the South Dakota State Bank.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of propaganda in the news that South Dakota's in this big boom because they've got oil there, and that has nothing to do with it. It's actually the state bank that's keeping the unemployment.
That's right, and it has been since 1919 or 1917 or whatever the year was that they incorporated it.
Yeah, I'm not sure when they founded it. However, I really think that's the answer. If the Occupy movement would get behind the idea that the banks will always have the power, as long as we're in the system, they will always have the power.
Yes.
The closer the power to the people, the better.
There is a bill in the California Assembly to create a state bank for California.
Exactly.
And if California had a state bank and people could, and just simply the state took the money that they have on deposit with Bank of America and Wells Fargo and they put it in their own state bank.
Fund.
Yeah, exactly. You're absolutely right, James. You've got it nailed. And if they took that money, if the state of California took that money that they've got invested with big corporate banks and invested it with a state owned bank like South Dakota does, that the profit made from that banking would go a long way toward and may even entirely resolve. According to Ellen Brown, who's a real expert on this, you can read about this at webofdebt.com. According to Ellen Brown, it would solve the California financial crisis. So you're spot on. Cheryl in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Cheryl, what's up?
Hi there. I just wanted to update you on, you know, we passed in Boulder the question 2H corporate personhood.
Yes, 73% of the people, the good citizens of Boulder said, no, corporations are not people, and speech, actually they said yes to the assertion that corporations are not people, money is not speech, and the Congress of the United States should amend the Constitution to say same.
And good on Boulder for doing that.
Amen.
But what gets overlooked is this ironic thing that happened simultaneously. The people of Boulder were trying to get a question up and passed to become independent of Xcel Energy Corporation's electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And Xcel threw just under $1 million into this campaign to make sure it was defeated,
right.
And it was soundly defeated.
Well,
only 180 people voted for it.
Wow. See, that's the power of $1 million in advertising. It's the same thing that happened. We had David Sirota and his wife, Emily, I think was her name, on this program last week or thereabouts, and because she was running for school board in Denver.
Right.
And she was up against a corporate-funded, fat cat-funded candidate who outspent her something like 14 to some incredible amount of money and beat her ultimately, because typically in American politics, whoever spends the most money wins, which is why Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank versus Bilotti and Citizens United, these decisions by the Supreme Court, that have increased the power and access of great wealth and corporations to the electorate have been so corrosive. So excellent point, Cheryl. Thank you for calling and making it and informing our listeners. It's much appreciated. Shan in Long Beach, California. Hey, Shan, what's up?
Hey, let me start by saying we in the black community, we've always known who the 1% was, but nobody ever seems to come down and ask us what we think. But so this is no, knowing who the 1% is no surprise to us. We've been known that. But
yep.
Anyway, moving forward, when the Republicans shot down the bill to fund more police, well, what is the need for more police if they're going to go and do the bidding of the 1%? And crack the heads of the poor 99%. We don't need them. So maybe it's good that the funding didn't get passed by the Republicans for them, because if they're going to go out there and do the type of things that they're doing in Oakland, we don't need them. Let them stay at home. Let them stay laid off.
Well, Shan,
doing the bidding of the rich.
Shan, first of all, there are many communities that don't that actually want community policing, good policing, and don't have access to it because police forces and police departments are stretched thin. Secondly,
listen to me. But the problem with that argument is if they start occupying them areas, those same police is going to go do the same thing to those people.
Yeah, they're going to come from someplace else. Okay, then let me go to my second argument, if I may. And the second argument is that when we start treating and when we start raising the standards for people to become police officers and we start paying them well enough that genuine professionals, like you would see in most European countries, come in and instead of, you know, Yahoo's looking for a gun and a stick, then you're going to see a change in the nature of policing in the United States. And I think in some communities we've actually seen that, but not in most. So, you know.
1,000%.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that point.
Yeah, we can't have a society without police. What we need to do is change the nature and character of our police departments. They are highly militarized and they are lowly paid. And that's a bad combination. So I'm with you, Shan. Thank you very much for the call. In Phoenix, JD. Hey, JD, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm a big fan. I listen every day.
Thank you.
You asked the question earlier about whether violence was unavoidable.
Yeah.
I think that violence is unavoidable because the police are institutionally violent. There's going to be violence. But the degree or the amount of that violence is going to depend upon the protesters. Now, I want to just for a brief second here analyze history for a minute. In 1968, the American people turned against, the majority of American people turned against the Vietnam War.
Sure.
And that progressed all the way to 1975 to when it finally ended.
Yeah.
In 68, Nixon narrowly won the presidential election running as the law and order candidate.
Well, he was also running as the peace candidate. He was going to end the Vietnam War. He had a secret plan to attend the Vietnam War.
Well, that was nonsense. Everybody knows that's nonsense.
But he was. I mean, go back. We've played the clip before of Lyndon Johnson having this conversation with Everett Dirksen.
He didn't run as a peace candidate until 1972.
Well, in 72, yeah, that was when he had the secret plan. But no, he was going. You're absolutely right. In 68, he was not campaigning on ending the war. He was campaigning on winning the war. You're right. Okay, I stand corrected. But the point is that he was in the background. He was, you know, that September, LBJ had gotten the South Vietnamese to say that they would sit down to the Paris peace talks and work things out with the North Vietnamese, and they were going to end the war. And that would have guaranteed Hubert Humphrey's election. And Nixon contacted the South Vietnamese and said, don't do it. I'll give you a better deal, and I'll make you rich. And so they didn't do it. They refused to participate in the Paris peace talks going up to the election in 68. And that's why Nixon won. That war continued. Had LBJ ended the war, as he had all in place, and when he and this was just released by the Lyndon Johnson Library last year, these tapes. I mean, we first learned about this last year because they've been sealed for a certain number of years. LBJ calling up Everett Dirksen, the head Republican in the United States Senate, saying, Everett, I'm reading their hand. I'm looking at what they're doing. I've got the tapes of their conversations. This man, Richard Nixon, is committing treason.
Well, you have deflected my argument. Let me just briefly say that in 1972, George McGovern, who ran as the peace candidate,
right, Real quick, please.
Suffered the worst loss in the history of elections for president in this country. And it was because of the violence. People were more opposed to the violence coming from the left.
To the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think you're right, JD, in part. You know, the government was also a flawed candidate in some ways, but I think you're right. The violence was, arguably, there was a backlash to it. Thank you for the call.
If you silently wait for the top to create, they say, for the common treasure.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And check out the website. It explains the whole thing there in great detail. Ellen, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. I guess the big news is we had our staff up on Capitol Hill just a few feet from here, and Speaker Boehner was doing a news conference. He was asked by Luke Russert, Tim Russert's son, who's a reporter, does Norquist's presence have a bad influence on the Republican conference? And he answered, well, we're here about creating jobs. It's not often I get asked about some random person.
Grover Norquist is some random person.
I mean, I would love to have seen Norquist's face.
Yeah. Well, you know, Norquist is getting some bad press lately. I mean, the old stories about him and Jack Abramoff are starting to come out again.
Well, by the way, our very own Bob Ney will be on 60 Minutes with Abramoff on Sunday night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That should be interesting.
So you can watch that.
Yeah.
Senate has some votes at 3 p.m. today. One, $50 billion for construction, along with $10 billion for an infrastructure loan fund. The Republicans say, oh, yeah, we'll go along with that. We'll extend the highway loan fund, but you better get rid of some federal regulations. They're going to need 60 votes to get either to the floor, and doesn't look like it's going to happen, either the Democrat proposal or the Republican. The House is going after security regulations. They want to be able to people to be able to advertise new securities on the Internet. They also are going to support, it looks like, and this may get bipartisan support, but who knows what happens in the Senate, $2 million to raise for crowdsourcing without registration of the FEC. So if we started Hartman Ratner Enterprises, we could crowdsource, we could ask people for contributions on the Internet without having to go to the FEC. It's an interesting proposition.
Without having to go to the Federal Election Commission.
Communications
Commission?
Yeah.
FCC?
FCC, sorry. Yes. Sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So why would we have to right now?
Because, well, we do did I say election commission? You know what I'm talking about, the people that regulate money.
Oh, the Internal Revenue Service.
No, not Internal Revenue Service.
Political money.
Political
money. Yeah,
that's
the FEC, the Federal Election Commission.
So,
yeah, you were right.
So that's where it would have to go.
So if we were raising money for a political candidate or political purpose.
Well, and a corporation now, and a corporation, any corporation.
Amazing.
I'm getting my agencies mixed up,
yeah,
but you know what I'm saying.
I'm with you.
You're with me on that one. Okay, the super committee, no closed door meeting this week. The deadline, they're going to try and ask that be extended. This is the grand bargain also that, of course, Steve LaTourette is trying to work out from the great state of Ohio. You know how much I love Ohioans, even if they're Republicans.
Oh, you grew up there.
I grew up there. So he's trying to work out this 40 Republicans, of course. A lot of them have signed Grover Norquist's pledge.
And they just signed a letter saying put taxes on the table.
That's right.
I'll bet they're swallowing hard, and that's probably why Boehner says, Norquist?
Right.
Who's the?
Yeah,
some
exactly.
Some random person?
Yeah. Okay, 14 to 9 today in a House Energy Committee said that they want to subpoena the documents from the White House. Well, the Department of Energy has already given out 80,000 documents, pages of documents on the cylinder thing, 1,200 from actually the White House. So they are going on a complete fishing expedition.
This is Daryl Issa, one of the few actual
and Fred
criminals.
Upton, actually.
Yeah.
Fred Upton, Republican.
But Fred Upton is not a criminal. Daryl Issa actually was a criminal before he became a member of Congress. And I find it incredible that he's the head guy looking for crimes.
Well,
now,
the White House has said just narrow the scope and we'll let out the documents, but we're not going on a huge fishing expedition. I think 80,000 pages of documents from the Department of Energy, 1,200 including the White House, is quite enough.
Yeah, this has shades of Travelgate and Rose Partnergate and all the other Clinton administration fishing expeditions by the Republican House of Representatives.
Now, it's interesting. Ed Markey, who, of course, used to run that committee, too, said, unlike this subpoena, that he actually had, when he was in charge of the committee, he got Sensenbrenner, who was his ranking member, and they issued it jointly. And they only issued one subpoena to the White House, to the Bush White House. So why are they going on this huge fishing expedition?
Right. So when the Democrats were in charge, they did it right. Now that Darrell Issa is running the show, he's gone all Joe McCarthy.
Right. Now, also be careful of how things are moved ahead, because General Odinero, who is the Army Chief of Staff, he said, well, if they go through this $1 trillion cut, $100 billion a year over 10 years for the Department of Defense, it's going to be a horribly unacceptable risk, he's saying. However, what is immune from this across-the-board cut, if the super committee doesn't come up with the cuts, is any war funding. So what they can just do is to move this money to war funding, and then it's immune from the Department of Defense.
Slick trick.
And a slick trick. And also, just in case people don't remember, since 9/11, the 10 years since 9/11, the Department of Defense budget and actual dollars has doubled.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what do you have any idea what percentage of that extra 100% or 50% of the current budget is represented by Iraq and Afghanistan?
I don't, although it's obviously extremely high.
Yeah.
I mean, depending on who you talk to, it's either, $1 or $3 trillion more because of all the other funding, veterans, et cetera,
right,
that we now have. By the way, a personhood amendment is going on in Florida. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's also DNC chair, is having a news conference. I think it's actually going on or just happened, about personhood in Florida. This is also the same thing in Ohio. So people from around the country listening to your show, Tom, ought to be looking at their state legislatures and finding out what they're doing with personhood. In Ohio,
if I may interrupt,
yes,
we're not talking about corporate personhood, which we talk about a lot. We're talking about the idea that the moment that an egg is fertilized by a sperm, even though it hasn't implanted, it's not viable, there's not even a possibility, that it is considered a person, can have an attorney assigned to it, and a woman could be... She could have an ankle bracelet put on her throughout her pregnancy.
Even if she takes the pill for the non-attachment of the...
Right. This outlaws birth control pills. This outlaws the IUD. But I think more importantly, it puts the state in the life of that woman for the next 9 months. And these conservatives?
These are Republicans who... Yeah, exactly. What planet are these guys on? Speak with forked tongue.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So while the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. More people are in the bottom half, below 50% of poverty now in the United States than at any time since the government started keeping statistics. It's really pretty shocking. Over 20 million Americans now living in this extreme poverty. So what do we do about it? Wayne Root, the former Libertarian vice presidential nominee, currently the chairman of the Libertarian National Congressional Committee, author of The Conscience of a Libertarian, Employing the Citizen Revolution with God, Guns, Gold, and Tax Cuts, website rootforamerica.com, is back with us. Wayne, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. You wrote an op-ed called The Obama Plan, Insanity for Karl Marx. And I'd like to just go through it point by point with you, if I may.
You got it.
Okay. You say, first, we have the housing crisis. Obama's solution to the problem that millions can't afford to live in their homes is to pay their mortgages because banks were pushed by government to use the criteria of affirmative action to award mortgages. These are your words. I'm just assuming for a moment, Wayne, that you actually believe this lie. Can you please name one bank, just one, because you and I both know that if there was one bank anywhere in the United States that this had actually happened to, it would have been splashed all over Fox News. It would have been on Drudge for months. Please name one bank that was forced to give one mortgage. Let me just finish the sentence. Name one bank that was forced to give one mortgage to one person. One example.
Tom, you're living in a dream world here. Listen, government.
Just one example.
Government is the person that's at fault for all of this.
Just one example.
Terrible, but they just went along with what government was doing, which was guaranteeing loans, guaranteeing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and asking banks if they wanted to stay in business and do their mergers and do their business as usual, they would have to go along with the government's rules called the Community Reinvestment Act to give to up their standards of giving loans to minorities and poor people.
Wayne, have you ever read the Community Reinvestment Act? I would bet, I don't want to get into betting money, but I'll bet you haven't read the Community Reinvestment Act. I have, or at least a good chunk of it. And what that law said was that redlining is no longer legal. That law outlined the power of a bank, and banks were using this extensively, to say, you may not get a loan here because of your zip code. What it said was, if somebody in an area that the bank has traditionally said, we don't lend in that area, if that individual qualifies according to the standards of accepted banking practices, and that's the phrase you'll find right there in the law, then you cannot deny them a mortgage based on their zip code.
Tom,
that has nothing to do with
intent.
Forcing a mortgage.
Original intent in the 1970s, it was supercharged under Bill Clinton and beyond by Barack Obama and Acorn.
It was not.
Protested at
it was not. You're throwing out words, Wayne. Give me one example. One example of one bank that was forced to give one mortgage, and I will believe you. You can't find one example.
Because of subprime mortgages. What are you talking about?
You can't find one example.
What happened.
You can't find, if Citibank had been forced to give a mortgage to some guy named Joe Blow living in Oakland, California, and that mortgage went bad, you don't think that would be, Sean Hannity would be waving the page, here's the guy that Citibank was forced to give that mortgage. No, sorry. There aren't any.
Let's get off the topic of whether
okay,
a person was forced
let's,
to
let's
do
move
it.
To the next
because
one then. You say the rule of law. Let's go to your second one then. You say the rule of law doesn't matter. Contracts no longer matter. The ability to pay your bills no longer matters. Yes, I agree with you. That was the policy of the Bush administration. Ignore all those things and give the banks $800 billion.
Well, we're on the same
side of
that one. I agree with the Occupy Wall Street protesters on one specific thing, and that is I'm for capitalism. I don't have any problem with banks or bank presidents making money. I have no problem with stockholders making money. That's called capitalism. I do have a problem with bailouts. They should be allowed to fail. When they fail, you got to teach them a lesson, and you can't take the
then you have an argument with George W. Bush
and give it to the banksters.
Wayne,
that is wrong, and it's against the Constitution.
Wayne, you have an argument with George W. Bush, not with Barack Obama. Yeah, I think
we
agree on this.
Obama, he didn't participate in the bailout.
No, the bailout was passed during the Bush administration. It was administered during the Bush administration.
As well under Obama. And you know what another word
Obama has not passed any more money to the banks.
What about GE? Is GE as bad as the banks?
Obama did not pass any more money to the banks.
What's that?
Obama has not passed any more money to the banks. GE is not a bank. It is a corporation, and they did get a lot of money during the last years of the Bush administration. You're right. Bernie Sanders audit. Okay, we'll all agree that that was a terrible thing. Okay, you go on and you say Obama's voter, although you're blaming this on Obama, you say Obama's voters obviously believe money grows on trees. They also believe the way to solve the debt crisis is by printing more fake money. And I would say, yes, that's what Bush did for 2.5 years, with two wars and a huge tax cut, none of which were paid for. What Obama did that has caused the debt to suddenly get much larger is he said, that Iraq war and that Afghanistan war that Bush said were going to cost us $2 billion and would pay for themselves with the oil we got from them, and so he never bothered to put them on the budget? Those didn't show up in the budget in the last 5 years of the Bush administration that we were fighting those wars. Obama said, I'm going to take that Defense Department money and actually put it in the budget. And all of a sudden, you're seeing an extra $200, $300, $400, $500. Actually, you're seeing probably close to $1 trillion in defense spending. Defense spending has doubled since 9/11.
Hey, Tom,
100% increase.
Agree?
Now it's on the budget.
Tom,
how can you blame Obama for simply pointing out what Bush did?
Tom, obviously you must think you're sitting with a Republican. You're sitting with a libertarian who is not here to only criticize Obama. Who's here to tell you every president.
Your article does not mention George Bush anywhere, and every
George
sentence
Bush
starts out with Obama.
One of the worst presidents in American history.
And in fact, it's titled "The Obama Plan: Insanity or Karl Marx." And I'm saying no. This is George Bush's policy. Obama's trying to fix this.
If you don't like Bush, then you can't like Obama. If liberals who say Bush spent too much and had too many wars could possibly say Obama's doing better, you're all high on the very thing you like, marijuana.
I think by the end of this year, we will be out of Iraq, and we will be out of Afghanistan.
More spending, more debt. Same policies, except supercharged.
No, they're not the same policies. They're very much not the same policies. And for example,
you know,
what Obama did in the Middle East is, Wayne, you got to let me finish a sentence once in a while. What Obama did is he went over to the Middle East and he said, tear down these dictators. And what Bush did is he went into the Middle East and he started dropping bombs.
And they're both bad policies because neither one is working. I hate to tell you, Bush was a failure. I'm not for the war.
He didn't notice what happened in Egypt.
Get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, but get out of Libya and get out of the new nation in Africa we're going into too. Get out of all of them. We have nothing to do with them. I'm with you. On the other hand, the Arab Spring, Tom, if you and your liberal friends think that's working out well, disaster for America, disaster for Israel. It's going to lead to war around the world.
We shall see. Okay, you say that a successful business owner has to pay his or her mortgage and property taxes in full, and now you're asking them to also pay for millions of others to live in their homes for free, subsidized by the taxpayer. A, I don't recall Obama ever saying that. I wish he had. And B, I think we need to be clawing back this money from the banksters who stole it.
But here's my point, Tom. The money has to come from somewhere. Money grows on trees. You can't forgive student loans, and you can't ask banks to keep people in homes that can't pay for them, because in the end, the money's going to have to be paid for out of the taxes of Americans.
Well, this is your point about the student loans. You go after Obama for taking the student loans out of the hands of private banks that were skimming 10, 20, in some cases as much as 40% profit off the top, and putting it into a government agency that operates on a 3% overhead. Why? That makes no sense to me. Why would you criticize Obama for that?
I'm not for government ever taking over anything because they fail in everything they do. And second of all,
that works just fine.
What I'm complaining about here is that government, Obama's new proposal, is to tell everyone who has a student loan at the end of 20 years, you don't owe it anymore.
Okay.
Whatever's left is gone.
So are you suggesting, Wayne, that we should open all our jails?
What's that?
Are you suggesting we should simply open all our jails and let everybody out because government doesn't work?
Well, government runs jails pretty inefficiently, too. As a matter of fact, I'm on your side on a point. We should talk about medical marijuana, legalizing marijuana. Why are hundreds of thousands of people in jail for minor drug offenses?
Are you suggesting that we should end all our fire departments, that we should just tell all our firefighters to go home? Sorry, government doesn't work.
Stop the $100,000 pensions, yes.
Okay. Yeah, screw the firefighters. Okay.
I don't have $100,000 pensions.
That's going to work really well.
Are you screwing me?
Yeah, I think we should all have pensions. Okay, Root for America is the website. Wayne Root is the candidate, or was the candidate, Libertarian vice presidential nominee. Thanks, Wayne.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, your calls. How do we bring about actual true change in America? Plus a quick geeky science, the fingerprints of poverty.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
It's our geeky science moment. We're during the 1 3-minute moment during the entire week where I can share with you one of my favorite science stories. One of the ones Denisovians mated with humans, I thought that was fascinating, but I'll save that for some time later. Neanderthals also mated with humans. We're finding a lot as we dig into our DNA. But speaking of our DNA, a study has been done by a group of scientists who have been looking at a group of people that they have been studying since the 1950s. And what they have found is what they refer to as epigenetic changes in DNA, reprogramming of DNA as a result of poverty. And these changes take place in utero. In other words, if mom is living in poverty, the DNA of the baby forming in her womb actually changes. Now, I wrote about this actually in my book, The Edison Gene, and the point that I made was that the baby and mom are constantly, baby is constantly interrogating mom saying, is that world out there hostile? And mom is constantly feeding back to the baby whether it is or it isn't. Typically, the main feedback loop is a chemical called cortisol, which we all produce when we're under stress. And if the developing fetus notices a lot of cortisol in its umbilical cord blood, then what happens is that the hindbrain, which is responsible for fight or flight response, the brainstem part of the brain and the lower part of the brain, gets larger and more functional. So the fight or flight response is exaggerated. Whereas if there's very little cortisol coming down through that blood, in other words, if mom is feeding back, no, everything's fine, we're living okay, you know, there's enough food, we're not in risk, nobody's shooting out in the front yard, then the baby gets in response to that lack of cortisol, the baby's forebrain develops, the thinking, feeling, emotional, empathetic part of the brain develops, and the hindbrain, the lower brain, the fight or flight brain actually gets smaller. So you get people who are smarter and more empathetic. And this happens before the child is even born. And now that's the point that I pointed out in my book, The Edison Gene. What he's found is that not only is this response to the environment real, which I think we've known for probably the better part of 60 years, but it is actually not just real, it actually is a reflection of changes in the baby's DNA, epigenetic changes. Changes that baby, when that baby grows up to be an adult man or woman, will be passed along to their children. So, you know, the consequences, they call this the fingerprint of poverty. It can be multi-generational. I find that just mind-boggling. And a great argument for going back to Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and saying, we are going to make an America. We're going to declare a war on poverty, if you want to use that awful war metaphor. We're going to go back to an America where poverty is not an issue. Now, good luck to convincing the Republicans of that. But here is good science to back it up. Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle with an update on Occupy Seattle and Jamie Dimon and all that kind of stuff. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, America's number one bankster had a pretty outspoken welcoming committee yesterday. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon was here to speak to business students from the University of Washington. And by the way, Occupy Seattle has formed a pretty tight coalition with teachers and students in the city. And our Occupy camp is now at Seattle Central Community College, where we were invited by the students and the faculty.
Wow.
But some of the UW students walked out to protest Dimon's visit, and 300 people surrounded the Sheraton Hotel where he was speaking.
Wow.
And members of a group called Working Washington helped put that together, and we supported them. Earlier in the day, protesters marched on a Chase Bank where 6 people were arrested when they did a sit-in inside the bank. Unfortunately, the Seattle Police Department decided to use pepper spray on the demonstrators about a half dozen times throughout the day,
ouch,
including outside of the Sheraton. But our message to Dimon was no more business as usual for corporate CEOs and Wall Street bankers, and I think we had a great success because we put tons of pressure on him. We probably scared the pants off of him, actually, considering how many police were around the building. But, you know, we just wanted to send him a message that Wall Street bankers who have bankrupt their companies and been paid off by taxpayers and are still making millions themselves are not really welcome in Seattle.
Yeah,
so
and in fact, increasingly, instead of being viewed as heroes, which is what he came in to be, a hero to all these business students, they are being viewed as the villains. They're being viewed as the criminals in our societies, the outlaws, and the outcasts. And shaming them like this and pointing that out is wonderful. Mark, thank you very much for the update and for the report. Adam in Peoria, Illinois. Yeah, Adam, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I got some breaking news from Occupy Wall Street. But real quick, I just wanted to show some solidarity with our people here at Occupy Peoria. And also Occupy Bloomington Normal. They're having an event November 5th, something they're calling a really, really free market. Basically kind of like if you need supplies, come up, take what you'll use, you know, bring anything you don't need so people can trade for their, local occupation.
Oh, how great. Okay.
But real quick, it looks like we're getting to the News Corporation. I'm not sure if you saw the headline of the New York Post today, the front page of it, actually. It said basically real big enough, time to restore decency to the Zuccotti Park, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it looks like Chris Hedges was one of the people arrested at the sit-in just about a half hour ago at Goldman Sachs.
Well, in what city? In New York?
Yeah, in New York.
Yeah, so there was a sit-in at Goldman Sachs. Okay, great. Thanks for that update, Adam, and for the shout-out to all of your friends. Karen in Portland. Karen, we have about a half a minute. Is it a quick one?
Oh, okay. Hi. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say we need to have an operating system for the movement that's based on sound values of caring about one another and caring for one another, and we're seeing it in the Occupy movements all across the country.
Yes.
Especially here in Portland, I know about, and we're taking care of people. I think it helps us to stay away from nonviolence, away from violence, and it helps us to aim for a democratic socialist kind of economy. That's what I think that's the next stage of development, and I think that's where we get there by not promoting violent people.
Totally agree with you, Karen. And in fact, I would say that the next stage the higher evolution is European-style democratic socialism. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the insanely ugly, well, actually some larger vocabulary word, right? And your calls. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very holocryptically ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, Steve Murphy, the Democratic strategist, often plays the role of sacrificial lamb on the Sean Hannity show, stepped up last night and called out the Hannitizer for what he is, a conservative propagandist. After Hannity praised himself as being one of the few voices in the media to hype the President Obama Bill Ayers connection, Murphy spoke up. And here it is.
This isn't the media.
This is a conservative propaganda show.
This isn't the media.
Oh, excuse me.
Probably the last time he'll be invited back. For a moment, Hannity was left speechless before telling Murphy to suck it up and stop whining. I think it's fair to say that Murphy won't be back, invited back for a while. But hey, getting a chance to tell a little truth on Fox so-called news, also known as GOP TV, probably worth it. Well done. The bad. Congressman Jeff Duncan, the Republican from South Carolina, was speaking with students in a Q&A and delivered this disturbing analogy to highlight our nation's immigration problems. Congressman Duncan said, quote, "It's kind of like having a house, taking the door off the hinges and allowing any kind of vagrant or animal or just somebody that's hungry or somebody who wants to do your dishes for you to come in, and you can't say no, you can't come in, and you can't say no, you can't stay all night, or you can't use this, you can't have this benefit using my deodorant." End of quote. Right. Illegal immigration is akin to animals sneaking into your house, doing your dishes, and using your deodorant. Anyone else have those same problems with undocumented immigrants? I didn't think so. And the very, very ugly Congressman Tom Price, the Republican from Georgia, went on GOP TV, Fox so-called news this morning, and was asked some surprisingly tough questions about why Republicans are focused on passing bills that reaffirm the "In God We Trust" as the national motto, and not passing bills to create jobs. Price defended the "In God We Trust" vote by saying the resolution was necessary because we felt it was appropriate to remind the president what, in fact, the motto of our great country is. It was an opportunity to say, no, Mr. President, the motto of this country is not E Pluribus Unum, it is "In God We Trust." End of quote. Actually, it was our founding fathers who made the motto of this country E Pluribus Unum, which is Latin for "out of many, one." It was changed during the Cold War to "In God We Trust" to distinguish us from the so-called godless communists. I guess Republicans wanted to reaffirm the motto to distinguish themselves from President Obama, who must be a godless socialist or a Kenyan Muslim or fill in the blanks, the Republican boogeyman of the week. All in all, it was a waste of time. It didn't create a single job. Another wasted day in the House of Representatives run by the Republicans. And it was very, very ugly. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It is just, it's pretty amazing. John in Portland. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Thanks
for waiting on hold more than an hour. I know you've been there
for a while.
Sure,
no problem.
Appreciate it.
This is John from Occupy Portland, and we need a simple motto for the whole movement, and I got it. It's an American flag with a sold sign on it, because if you think about it, that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah.
We sold our infrastructure, we're selling our commons, and even our real estate.
Well, you know what I've been doing on this show and I've been doing on the TV show at night is I've started referring to the people in the Occupy movement, typically in the media they're referred to as protesters. I'm referring to them as patriots. I want to reclaim that word. And I agree with you that the American flag is a great logo. And I think that the Occupy movements all over this country would do themselves a tremendous favor if they started placing American flags at the four corners of whatever it is they're occupying and saying, this is, we're standing up for genuine American values. This is America right here. And with or without the sold sign.
In other words, the alternative is a lot of people turn the flag upside down.
No, I wouldn't do that.
Wouldn't do it either. Having it right side up, and it really has been sold. And that's what the... That's the bottom line. That's really
well. That's what you're protesting. So, but I would say let's just adopt the flag as our motto, and let's start referring to the Occupy folks as American patriots because that's what they are. Very, very good point, John. Thank you for raising it, James in Ontario, Canada. Hey, James, what's up?
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the financial system. What I want to know is how these people can keep talking about all the financial crisis, and they never mention the money supply. And the money supply is the key to the whole thing.
Right, and the money supply is created by privately owned central banks pretty much worldwide.
Well, yes, they keep doing that. The thing is, if you were discussing the a failing manufacturing system, you would at least consider the electrical supply to those factories because that's fundamental.
Right.
If you were discussing a failed food supply system, you'd discuss the fact that the rain isn't coming down from the sky or the water's not coming up from the well.
Right.
But the money supply is what the whole financial system runs on. And it's because the money supply is so unstable that the world financial system is in such a crisis,
right,
and it continues and it continues.
And let me give you a 15-second summary of Ellen Brown. If you can read the more complex version of this in her, I think it's a 800-page book, webofdebt.com is the website, but also her commentaries on it. And that is that the way that our largely for-profit privatized central banks, at least in most of the developed world countries, the way that they create money is by creating debt. So the minute that money is brought into being, the only way that you can bring money into being is to create debt. So if you go down to the bank and you take out a $100,000 loan, literally that bank creates $100,000 out of thin air. They also create out of thin air the debt associated with that $100,000 called interest. So let's say it's a 7% loan. They actually created $100,000 plus 7% over the lifetime of the loan, which might be another $50,000 or $60,000. So they create $150,000 out of thin air. $50,000 of that is just pure profit for the bank and is going to have to be paid by somebody. So it's like chairs. At the end of the day, when the $100,000 is no longer there, in other words, when the debt is totally paid off, that $50,000 had to come from someplace to give that money to the bank, that profit to the bank. And typically where it comes from is out of our hides. And so this whole fractional banking system, based on debt, is one that is guaranteed to eventually crash. And that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing the crash of the fractional reserve banking system. And I don't want to push beyond that much in the conversation. Thank you for James for bringing it up because, people's eyes start glazing over and they don't get it. But here's the bottom line. The banking system is rigged. It has been rigged from the get-go. And whether it's the Federal Reserve in the United States or whether it's the European Central Bank or whether it's the Central Bank of Mexico or you fill in the blanks, Central Bank of Canada. Canada actually nationalized their central bank for a couple of years. And then they went back and said, oh, yeah, let's make it private again. The power of the banksters. And what you're seeing right now is the banksters having brought down the world, not just this nation. And you've got people all over the world standing up saying, enough. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Betty, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I want to run a couple of ideas by you and see what you think. The Republican Party, in my mind, was eviscerated before George Bush left office. I don't know why we continue to call them that, because they are, I think, decent Republicans left a long time ago, and now what's left is proof of the pudding. They can't even come up with a decent candidate to run for president.
Yeah.
I think that people who voted for these folks during the midterms, who misrepresented themselves so, have finally figured out what the deal is. Now you've got
this
Occupy.
Is if I may interject, this is why Mitt Romney has, it's been 600 and some odd days since he's shown up on a Sunday program. He's in the Mittness Protection Program. He's not doing public appearances. He's only doing the debates. He's keeping his head down because he knows that the party has gone crazy. And if he has to start responding to questions from either real reporters or right wing reporters that will elicit the kind of crazy responses that the base requires, he will be in deep trouble. Thus, the Mittness Protection Program.
Now we come into Occupy. Occupy, in my estimation, represents so much more beyond a movement. And I get breathless talking about it because I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime. Right now, to me, this represents the long overdue emergence and probably creation in the making of our next political party. And I honestly believe that even possibly within the year, we're going to have a spokesperson for this movement, a.k.a. party, and the Democrats can either benefit from this if they move in a certain direction, but if they choose to stay exactly what they are, where they are, or move further to the right, they're going to be where the Republicans were, and we are looking at our new party in the making right now.
Yeah, I agree with the second half of what you're saying. I don't think that this is going to morph into a party any more than the Tea Party morphed into a party. I think it's going to morph into a movement probably within the Democratic Party, much like the Tea Party morphed into a caucus or a movement within the Republican Party. It's populist. What we're in now, right now, is a populist era, populist time. And, you know, the Democratic Party is actually fairly adaptable. Look at what happened when Franklin Roosevelt was president. Look at what happened when LBJ was president, setting aside the Vietnam War, the Great Society. The Democratic Party has at times done some really good stuff. And this is the time, frankly, for that infiltration to happen. But I don't think it's going to be a third party. We'll see. We'll see.
You're
welcome. Thank you, Betty. And thanks for listening to KABQ in Albuquerque. You may be right. I suspect not. I suspect that there's not going to be a political party out of this, that this is movement politics, not party politics. And the job of the party is to get with the movement, not the other way around. But we'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think a lot of people miss the distinction, by the way, between parties and movements. And they're very, very different things. Movements affect parties. Parties try to ignore movements.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Hey, and be sure and check out Bernie.org. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders will be on doing his national town hall meeting. Bernie.org is his campaign website. We don't mention that much when he's on the air. But I can mention it now. Well, I could mention it, but I am mentioning it right now. Bernie.org is where you can help out Bernie Sanders and his campaign. Please check it out. Carla in Oakland, California. Hey, Carla, what's up?
This is great. I just first want to be one of the voices of the people that were at the Occupy Oakland protest last night at the Port of Oakland, and it was very peaceful. And in fact, on our way back to the camp, people were dancing and singing in the streets, and the people of West Oakland were coming out and dancing along with us.
That's great.
Everything that happened after I left, which was after 10 p.m. But I was calling because I wanted to just kind of talk about or get some information about the Edison gene. Mm-hmm. I teach in West Oakland at a high school in West Oakland, and I'm intrigued by this. I haven't read your book yet, but I'm intrigued by this idea because it may explain in part the difficulties that I have as a teacher in teaching many of my students, and just it might account for just the low skills, the unbelievably low skills that some of our students have.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Children are affected in utero by their environment. There is this, he calls it, the scientist, this researcher calls it the fingerprint of poverty. It can be multi-generational. That's the bad news, right, is that poverty and stress produce children who are less intellectually functional and more physically functional. They're better at fight or flight. They're not as good at empathy and logic. On the other hand,
right,
the good news is that if you raise those children out of poverty, even though they may not be Albert Einsteins intellectually, give them a good factory job and let them have a good middle class life and raise their kids. That same epigenetic change in DNA that brought them down, shall we say, will bring the next generation up. And so this is nothing that is, connected to any particular group of people, any ancestry, any race, anything like that. This is the consequence of environment. This is how environment interacts with the human genome. This is why two identical twins are not, by the time they're adults, actually identical. I mean, they may look the same, but they don't behave the same because their DNA has expressed in different ways. And in fact, they'll have even slightly different medical conditions because their DNA has expressed differently as a consequence of slight variations in their environment.
Well, are there any suggestions for how a teacher could impact them before they're adults?
Yeah, you try to dial back the stress levels of the kids, keeping, you know, understanding that these kids are living in a world of stress, and they already have highly reactive, the basal brain, the reptilian brain, the lower brain. It's already highly reactive. They're very, very sensitive to cortisol, and so you want to try and put them in an environment that has the least amount of stress possible. These are the kids who benefit the most from a very, very low student-to-teacher ratio, you know, like 5 students per teacher, 10 students per teacher. The school I'm on the board of directors of has 4 students per teacher. I mean, these are the kids who benefit from that the very most, really hugely measurably. And
you know what, Tom?
Yeah.
Instinctively, I know that, and I'm trying to bring transcendental meditation into my classroom as well.
That's great.
But I'm in the Oakland Public School District. It's not going to happen.
Well,
I mean, anytime soon.
Yeah, and that's a political issue, and that's where you know, not just teachers but parents and anybody, frankly, who is concerned about the next generation, you know, which is going to be the next generation of leaders, the next generation of criminals. Take your choice. Anybody who's an American should be saying, we need to fund our schools better. We need to fund our teachers better. When we start doing, you know, the two highest educational score countries in the world are Denmark and Singapore. Radically different forms of government. Denmark is a social democracy. Singapore is basically a dictatorship. Radically different. You know, Singapore is a city state. Denmark has a lot of rural areas. What is the one thing that they have in common? The one thing that those two countries have in common is that in both those countries, it takes 6 years of college to be a teacher, just like it takes 6 years of college to become a doctor. And teachers are paid about the same as medical doctors, and they have the same level of respect in society. So they trust their teachers, they fund their teachers, and they get the very best people as teachers, and the same level of respect is given to the classroom. And, you know, the product of that is generations of Danes and Singaporeans who are doing really well. You know, it's generation after generation after generation. Carl, I've got to move along, but thank you for the call. Very thoughtful.
Thank you.
And thank you for being one of my heroes. You're a teacher. Those are true heroes in America. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to AM 960 there in San Francisco, Green 960. Alex in Silver Springs, Texas. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, I was just wanting to bring attention to the fractional reserve banking system.
Yeah.
And how we need to end that.
Yeah.
And end the Fed.
Yeah.
Because the Fed is a private organization. It's
yes.
It's about as federal as Federal Express.
You know how the Muslim countries do it?
What?
They say that it, you know, because interest is forbidden in the Quran. And so in the Muslim countries, they don't have this problem with fractional reserve banking because it's against the law. And so what they do is they say the only way that a bank can make money is by fees. So if you have a checking account, every time you write a check, there's a 10-cent fee. And so basically, it's just like any other business. You know, if I'm going to go, you know, buy a burger, I'm going to pay for the cost of the burger plus a small profit. That would be the fee. And so the bank gets their profits that way, but they're not creating money out of
money.
But the creation of the money is a function of the government. The government says, okay, here's the money supply. You guys, you know, you banksters can move it around, but you don't create more money when you issue a loan in those countries.
I think they both kind of like work together. Like the banksters are in control of the money.
Yeah, there is some crossover, but I'm not here to promote Islam. I mean, this is also in the Jewish and Christian Bibles that you shall not charge interest. I think, frankly, the root of the problem is the fractional reserve banking system. The best website for this is webofdebt.com, which is Ellen Brown's website, and I encourage you to check it out. Tomorrow, Friday, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us in our national town hall meeting, taking your calls. You can call and talk to a United States senator. And don't forget, plus Alan Grayson's going to be with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.